So welcome to the inquiry session. Let's just begin by sitting quietly together. You are familiar with the form now. The empty cushion is for one of you to come with a question. At any time, you may say thank you and leave, or I may say thank you or ring the bell, and that brings the inquiry to a close. Those listening, of course, are participants through your attention, through your presence. The followers of the Buddha were known as the ones who listened, the ones who were empathic. So as we listen, really listening rather deeply, not only to what's said externally, there's also a lot that's seen in the expressions of the face and the body language, but also listening inwardly to your own heart and mind, catching yourself if you are having a critical thought or a negative thought. Or if you're thinking, oh, this is too slow, it's too boring, it's too psychological, it's too this, it's too that. We do this. We have some kind of commentary often on what is going on. So you're asked to kind of catch that and check that. And then to be rather open and receptive, really deeply listening. And of course, the questions that people come with are questions for many of us. In between each inquiry, there'll be a silent moment, a few moments, and then I'll ask for the next person. There is a recorder. I have a recorder here. And it's also being recorded for Tovana. If you don't wish your inquiry to be on the website, then just let the managers know before the end of the retreat. It's not a problem. Either way. The purpose, of course, is freedom and depth of understanding for each of us here. Yes, anybody? Yes, come. A microphone's behind you. Need to turn it on, I think. Sorry. If you could say your name.
My name is Hemit.
Welcome. Okay.
Okay. I've got a daughter.
Yes.
She's got a son.
Louder.
I said, I've got a daughter and she's got a son.
Mm-hmm.
And her son has got problems, development problems.
Yes.
And I find a lot of sorrow,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes frustration, and feeling that maybe I know how to help. Also, what makes it harder is that I'm a therapist.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I can help directly,
mm-hmm.
but sometimes I feel that I want to tell her to go to this person or that person.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that I think about it a lot of my life.
Yes.
I feel peace in a lot of places in my life, but that brings me down.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to ask you, what do you advise?
Oh, okay. So when you do offer some suggestions to your daughter, what happens?
They've done a lot of things. It's not that they didn't do anything.
Yes.
But I think she doesn't, she's frustrated. She's tried and things are not going what the way that we wish it would go.
Of course.
And what I'm scared of, that it's also coming between me and her.
Ah, okay.
And our
your relationship with her.
Which is a good relationship, a close relationship.
So from your side, what do you think is wise to offer?
I'm more and more thinking that I need more empathy for her.
Yes.
Hardship.
Yes.
And not so to tell her or judge her.
Yes.
Be cross with her.
Yes.
Or be frustrated.
Oh, yes. There's the inner wisdom right there.
It's not so easy.
No, I know. So she is requiring the love of the mother to help her through her difficulty. And she's requiring love that is unconditional, not based on what she does or doesn't do.
Right.
And sometimes when we work as a therapist, the role comes into our life. What do you see is happening for you with the role of therapist?
I don't know where my responsibility starts and ends.
Yes, yes, yes.
I know. And I have, I know how to deal with children.
Is that your area of work?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Okay.
And that makes it harder to make the boundaries.
Yes. Yes. So she requires your unconditional support. Sometimes when we're a therapist, I know I'm a psychologist, we see rather easily what needs to be done and how to, sort out or fix something. So there's a clear path that's obvious to us in terms of what needs addressing. Yet in this situation, as you've seen, what's required is a different movement of the heart, not the information, not the decisions about what's done, but your love for her, your understanding of her. Yes. So that's your task. Yeah. Okay, so what do you need to do to love her unconditionally, to drop any judgment, to drop any criticism of her? What would it require of you?
To breathe.
Yes. We've been doing that for days.
Yes. To calm down.
Yes.
To believe there's light.
Yes.
At the end of the tunnel.
Yes. Yes. To put aside your worries, actually, because when we add our worry as a mother to the mix, we're adding to the difficulty. And it's totally understandable. I'm the mother of four children. I know. Yes. We do this. We tend to do this. All with wonderful intention.
Yes.
And yet sometimes we're the last person our children want to listen to. Especially when we think we know best. Okay, so it's the movement of the heart towards her rather than problem solving. Dropping any kind of negativity or criticism you have. And that will heal the second issue, which was your relationship with her. When do you see her next?
A this week, next week, I probably will see her, if not then the week after.
Okay.
Before Rosh Hashanah.
Okay. So you will see her soon.
Yes.
And you'll go with all the love in the world. And if you catch yourself telling her what to do, what will you do?
Think of you. And breathe. Calm
yes,
down.
Breathe. Calm down. Restraint with the words. Zip it, I say. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we need to know when to be silent as parents. And trust the intelligence of our children. Trust that they will find their way. And when there's a difficult issue, it's hard. It's painful.
Yeah.
And it's painful to see our children suffer. Because there's the loss that's associated with the child. Yet the child is the child that he is. As he is. These are the children you work with.
He's wonderful. He's got wonderful qualities.
Absolutely. Yes. He has wonderful qualities, yet you also see your daughter's heartbreak.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. And as mothers, it lands painfully.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the area you can address. Fully supporting her. Not judging, trusting her capacity to do the very best she can. And then with the grandson, you know what to do.
To play.
To play, to love, to enjoy his beautiful spirit. The body mm-hmm. may not be functioning fully as perhaps it...
Yeah.
A little bit, yeah. Maybe not. Whatever is happening, is happening. Love, playfulness, joy. That's the most important. You know, better than I in this circumstance. Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, anybody? Hi.
My name is O.
Welcome.
Thank you. I wanted to ask how to deal with physical pain during meditation.
Okay. What have you tried so far?
I had very strong pain in my legs.
Yes.
And I tried to, what I know how to do was just to dive into the pain.
Yes.
And I had an incredible experience.
Please tell us.
I dived in and I felt like very strong and ikatsutsim, tingling. And I went more in and more in, and then my whole body became tingled with tingling, and
yes.
It became, instead of painful, it became pleasure. And I felt the universe, and it was amazing. But then...
Oh. I'd stop
okay.
there.
Yes, okay.
Okay.
Yes, it was like an incredible moment I had today.
Yes,
one
yes.
of the most Yes.
Yes. So when we really give direct attention to the pain and try to find the center of the pain, sometimes there's this transformation of the energy from what we interpret as pain. Pain is an overarching word for a lot of different sensations. And then there was the transformation of tingling all through the body. And not only that, the universe.
Yes, it was amazing.
Yes, okay. What did you understand right then and there about pain?
That it's a sensation.
Yes.
And that maybe I can change my point of view from pain to pleasure.
Oh, okay. So maybe the way we perceive the sensations could be the issue. Okay, go on.
Yes. But then I tried it with other pain.
Yes.
In other places. Yes. And it didn't work.
Okay.
And it's very painful.
Okay. More work to do. More attention to be applied. So, I want to come back to this experience of the transformation. When there was the transformation of the pain from painful to pleasure, the painful to the pleasant, what then did you deeply know?
That I don't know what pain is, or that it's not what it seems.
Okay. So the world of appearances in the body and perhaps even externally is not perhaps as I interpret it or perceive it. Very interesting. So what would that mean for your life? The way we think things are is not necessarily so.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. This is huge, is it not? We think the world is one way. There's transformation, and we see the immediacy of the opposite. Pleasure and pain. It's a duality. And it can change from one to the other. What happened when you, I take it that you didn't like the pain, that's why you're sitting here. What happened when you felt the pleasure? What did the mind do?
So I immediately told myself not to get attached.
Oh, yes. Someone is listening. Brilliant. Yes. And?
And it kept going for quite a long time.
Beautiful. Okay, so the experience kept going when there was no attachment. When the mind wasn't saying, oh, wow, I want this to stay. So there was steadiness with the pleasant. Beautiful. Okay. And then you knew that that all happened. You understood the implication of it. You saw the wisdom that's associated with it. And then along came another pain. Is it still there?
The pain?
Yeah.
No.
No. Okay. So you tried again, and what happened?
It was in the next time that I meditated, and instead of my leg, it was my back, which has been hurting since I got here.
Yes.
And I tried the same thing, and in the back, it's not always painful. It's usually when I breathe out.
Okay.
So then I can't concentrate on it as I did on my legs.
Okay. If the pain is very strong, you will have no trouble focusing on it because it will be in the forefront of consciousness. When it's just coming and going a little bit, it can be a little more difficult. But one of the things we can do is we take the attention to that part of the body, and it's as if we kind of massage the whole area with the attention. There's kind of two ways of dealing with it. One is to try to diffuse the pain as if we were just lovingly with our attention going, you know, around the whole area. The other is what you did before, finding the very center of the pain. With arrow-like attention. So try that next time. The arrow-like attention to the very center of the pain. When you did that with the back pain, what happened?
Once it stopped being painful because I breathed in, there was nothing for me to center on. Yeah.
Mm. And so then the attention fades a little bit. It's not so clear.
Exactly.
Yes. So the recipe is attention. Sharp, focused, one-pointed attention to the very center of the pain. With the in-breath, the pain disappeared.
Yes.
And then again with the out-breath, did it return?
Yes.
Okay. So on the out-breath, you could imagine incredible relaxation. Try that. So okay. The out-breath is the breath, the part of the breath where it's most easy to relax, and we can direct the relaxation to the tension in the body. So try that.
Okay.
There is another method, of course, of dealing with pain, and it is to shift the focus away from the body altogether and to take the attention to sounds instead. So sometimes we need to give ourselves a break if we've been feeling lots of pain in the body. And so instead of focusing on the body as our foundation of awareness, we take the attention to sound, hearing. And then we just listen and we see the sounds arise and cease, arise and cease. So sometimes there's a kind of wise distraction that we can take up. Another method of dealing with pain, of course, is to change the posture. It's important that when we have a pain that we don't kind of do this all the time, like impulsively moving as a response to the discomfort. But rather, if we decide to move, we make a clear decision to move. If you're sitting, you can actually stand for 10 minutes. So you stand with your feet hip width apart and then sit again. And this is another way of bringing some release to an area of the body. It's kind of what it's wisdom to know when to move the body, when to change posture. And of course, there's all the sitting options on the floor, on a chair, on a stool, on a cushion stack is another way. So there's many things you can try. But I think your experience this morning tells you something rather extraordinary. It tells you that the way we see the world may not be the truth of things. That is big. It's potentially extraordinary. Because we think we know. The eye lands in the thought world and we think we know what's going on. We know how things are. We've seen it before, we know. So the eye can land there. We think we're right. Of course, and everybody else is wrong. Follows. Don't we do this? So your experience tells you something very important, and it is there is very often another way of looking at the world, that the way we think something is may not be so.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, anybody? Yes, come.
My name is Gali.
Gali, hello. I saw this little movement of your hand like this.
In my day-to-day,
yes,
sometimes I experience meditative states.
Yes.
And
good news.
And it might happen in work or dinner with friends.
Okay. What do you mean by meditative states?
Feeling very aware. I'm feeling very aware.
Yes.
And connected.
Yes.
To what is going on. Noticing.
Yes.
Hearing and seeing very clearly. And,
yes.
And then comes fear.
Ah, okay.
It's usually with the thought.
Mm-hmm.
Am I dissociating?
Oh, okay. All right. Have you had a response to that thought in your inner being? You ask, am I disassociating? What
yes.
do you think?
So grasping of self becomes very literal. Like I try to touch a scar I remember getting. I look in the mirror to see, oh, it's still the me I remember.
Yes, okay.
And fear.
Yes.
When it happens when I'm alone or here on the cushion, I'm very glad it happens.
Okay, let's talk about that. Here on the cushion, when you're sitting with the same kind of awareness, everything is wonderful if you open your eyes. There's sensitivity. The self, what's happening to the self?
I like someone said, no much self.
Not much self. No, not much self. And here on the cushion, you're really glad.
Yeah.
Tell me why. When there's not much self, what do you know?
It's not problematic.
No, there isn't a problem. Okay. The self's not getting us in trouble. Okay. So you know that it's not problematic. And so here, when that's happened, has there been any fear?
Not of these states, like fear coming of thoughts, scary thoughts that
yes.
I have. But
yes.
That experience of being aware is not scary to me.
Beautiful. Today. So it's you're not afraid when the self becomes very light and hardly there. When your ordinary sense dissolves, you are, when you hear, you are unafraid. Okay. Let's go to everyday life. In everyday life, sometimes the same are feelings and sensitivities emerge. There's a feeling of awareness, told me. There's sensitivity. And then the I thought comes in. What's the difference?
Maybe I have some kind of role in those situations, and then I'm stepping out of my day-to-day role because I'm not being Gali in the conversation. Now I'm
yes.
like not there.
Okay. So in everyday life, you feel there's some expectation of you to participate in a certain way. When you're at work, for example. Okay. And you suddenly this experience of awareness comes upon you. Say a little more about the fear.
So while I was thinking of coming and sharing, I found out I think it's loneliness.
Oh, say more.
So I think in that moment when I'm so very aware, I'm so very not with anybody.
Yes.
Although I for years thought that what makes me so very aware of my surrounding and mm-hmm. I'm so happy I can be aware of other people, mm-hmm. but then that's the fear of, like, am I disengaging, detaching
from my body? The fear is, am I disengaging, am I disappearing? Yeah. Is the self ceasing? Okay. So in the work situation, what work do you do, by the way?
I teach yoga.
Okay. In the work situation, you said you look at yourself and go, oh, I'm still here. Or you look in the mirror and say, oh, yes, I recognize that face. Okay. What else could you do to feel the body again?
I take deep breaths, mm-hmm. and I usually find out my pulse is very rapid. Mm-hmm. Like there's stress, fear, and there's stress.
Yeah. Okay, so fear is initially felt as a sensation in the body. Where do you feel it in the body? When you feel as if you're disappearing, and then the I thought comes and says, "I'm disappearing." Where in the body do you feel something?
Maybe in the pit of my stomach.
Yes.
Like in the abdomen.
Yes, this is very common. So there's the initial sensation. It's kind of like fright in the pit of one's stomach. Most of us will know this feeling. It's like, oh, there it is. And then you add the thoughts. The fear is constructed with the thoughts. I'm disappearing. I'm disengaging. I'm disassociating. From your yoga practice, what do you know about the body and mind?
So I used to refer to my experience as finding out like difference between prakriti, purusha, like difference between physical and not physical.
Yes.
But I'm not resonating with that anymore.
Okay.
So being aware of my breath, I feel like I am awareness. That's okay. But then fear comes. Fear is, like you said, physical. Like I have.
Okay, so there's the fear comes, the I thought is constructed, I'm disappearing. You're a yoga teacher, you know the body. You know this sensation. If you take direct attention to that sensation, what happens? Have you tried?
Yes. So since I have found out I have this fear, mm-hmm. it might disappear. Like I notice it and it fades away. It's not like for hours I'm not with any.
Yes. Yeah. So the fear is brief?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So let's stay with it for a minute. The sensation, the shortcut to end fear is to feel the feeling in the feeling. This is the Buddha's method. So we take the attention to the sensations in the pit of the stomach. Loving, kind sensations. Can you feel this sensation right now? Or not? No. Oh, bad luck. What can we do to give her a fright? Okay. So there's no fear. There's no fear there right now. Next time there's fear, take direct attention to that sensation. Track it and follow it and see what happens. That's one method. The other is to look at the thoughts. How many times has this fear come to you? Would you say 50 times? Would you say, how many times have you experienced this fear of the self disappearing?
Mm, A few hundreds of times.
A few hundred times. And did you vanish? Did you disappear? No. So the evidence is, I'm not going to disappear. Okay? The body is not going to suddenly dissolve and vanish and not be there. Okay, let's come back to this I thought. The fear is that the self will end, the self will cease. The self, which is known as me and mine, me, my, will disappear, will end. For sometimes in our meditation experiences, we have the fear of annihilation. We think if the ordinary self we know vanishes, who will I be? Are you saying you agree or don't agree?
I resonate.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So the fear is, if the self fades, what remains? So tell me from your direct experience, when the self fades away, is soft, is dissolves, is deconstructed, if you like, the ordinary sense of I, me and mine no longer remains. What then?
So for a few seconds, I feel the world around me.
Yes.
And it feels like a very authentic,
yes,
experience.
Like authentic meeting of you and the world, and yeah, you're part of the world.
Yeah, or seeing someone.
Yes, yes. So you are connected to other people, to all things. There's a feeling, a wonderful feeling of connection. And then?
Fear.
Fear. So the fear is I will disappear. There's great encouragement from me to explore this a little more. You know from your 300 times of feeling the fear that you will not disappear. Instead, it's the fear that will disappear, not you. Okay? So we trust our capacity to meet life. We trust the Dharma that we've been hearing about not self. We trust that we can have an experience of not self. You've just described it to me. It's not self. You know not self, and immediately there's this wonderful feeling of connectedness with all things. And then because that is a different experience from usual, the I pops itself up and says, what about me? The old ego wants to remain, to be here. Don't forget me. I'm in control, don't you know? The ego says, I'm joking now. But yes, the I thought comes rather strongly because it's the known, because it's familiar, because it's what we've become accustomed to. But our practice is about seeing in a fresh way, about seeing the new, about trusting our understanding, trusting our experience. You will not disappear. What will disappear is the fear itself. So the method is direct attention to the sensation, loving, beautiful, precious attention, as if we would cradle something, a flower, or we would hold a leaf that had just one drop of water on it and we didn't want to spill it. This is what I do with children. I get a leaf and I put a drop of water and they can walk and not, you know, walk like this. So we have this attitude of loving, kind attention to the tension in the stomach. And just like we heard before, there'll be a transformation. It's a quick, it's the shortcut to end the fear. And then, of course, the thought world. The fear is constructed with the thought, I might disappear, yet you know from your direct experience that doesn't happen. in our deep meditation experiences, we can, of course, have an experience where the body ceases altogether, or our connection with the body seems quite lost. Our connection with the mind can also end. Yet there is, when this happens, it's one of the realms we can experience. It's called the realm of neither perception nor non-perception. This is a deep meditative state. When this happens, there is a profound knowing that arises in the being. And this knowing is the knowing of freedom itself. So trust the Dharma, trust your understanding and your own depth of wisdom. And then fear will not rule your life. It won't stop you from doing things. I see that it didn't. I felt and saw the fear in your hand as you went like this. I said, anyone, and she went like that. Just a little movement. But then you came. You made the pilgrimage to the front. And what you've said is beautiful and precious. The experiences are lovely. So trust your wisdom, trust your understanding, and the fear will subside. The fear will cease, not you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just offer a short reflection with the first inquiry. The inquiry was really, how shall I be with my daughter when she's in such difficulty and pain? And it was beautifully answered with empathy, with love that's unconditional and unbound. Sometimes the role of parenting or a mother or father is extremely difficult. When we see the sorrow of a child, it's as because of some particular circumstance. As a mother or a grandmother, it can be almost a double kind of loss, or a double wound. We see the difficulty and our own heart responds to the difficulty, whatever it is. But then we also have the wish, of course, for our children not to suffer, for our children not to feel pain. And this can be an added burden. And so in our response, our wise response as a parent, we need to come with love rather than criticism, with support, rather than the voice of do this, do that, or problem solve. Sometimes, of course, when we're invited to problem solve, we problem solve. And sometimes the parent has extraordinary knowledge about what to do, as is probably the case here. So it's a matter of knowing when to say what we think as parents and knowing when to be silent. But most important is to have empathy and love that is boundless. The love and the care and the trust in the child, even though the child may be an adult, the trust in their intelligence, in their understanding, in their knowing is precious. And when we meet life like that, there's really a loosening up of the relationship. Then the relationship becomes incredibly free, because the daughter or son is free to be themselves, and we as parents can be free to be ourselves as well in that meeting. So the freedom needs to be all round. And sometimes it's wisdom to know when to drop the voice of the parent who knows best, or the parent who thinks they know what is best. Tell me, I know this story. So sometimes it's to meet the daughter, not as the daughter, but simply as another human being with a response of compassion, of love and care, and the role of mother or father fades. We give up our attachment to that particular role. And the other issue here, of course, is sometimes when we work in the field of therapy, the knowledge that we have from the therapeutic world becomes entangled in our own daily life. And we have to look and see when there's some kind of transference happening. With the second inquiry, we had this rather lovely exploration of pain and the realization that the way we perceive the world may not be the truth of how it is. Whatever we think may also be otherwise. And at this point, I remember a teaching story that I heard in India countless years ago, too many years ago to remember. And it's a story about a sadhu, a Hindu holy man, who is climbing up the mountain with a whole lot of people to the temple at the top on a holy day. So what happens is the whole village comes out and they begin to walk up the mountain. All the way up the mountain, the sadhu, holy man, is laughing. He's laughing all the way up the mountain. And the people say, "Why are you laughing? This is such a difficult climb. It's really steep and my legs are hurting. Why are you laughing?" They reach the top. They do the ceremony at the top in the temple. And then they come down. And of course, everyone, the villagers are all so happy on the way down, laughing all the way down the hill. And the sadhu is complaining all the way down the hill. And they get to the bottom and they say to him, "But you laughed all the way up and complained all the way down." And he said, "Yes, whatever you think, it may also be otherwise." You see? So what we think about the world, our impulse, our immediate reaction, may also be the opposite. So, of course, this applies to many things in life. It applies to everything we have a view about. And here in Israel, the views are quite potent and rather strongly held sometimes. And so it really takes, I'm being very tactful, it really takes some wisdom to see that we are holding to a position that actually is our opinion and view, and it may not be the truth of things. So part of our practice is to see the emptiness of views. It's to see the way that we perceive a situation and see a situation may not be the truth of things. We know something is the truth when it frees us up. We're touched by truth when there's a freedom. We heard it about the pain. There was the transformation from the difficulty to the freedom. When we're touched by truth, there's a freeing up that happens. We saw it in the first inquiry too, with the rather lovely initial response that you had. It was beautiful. Your own depth of wisdom just shone through. This is the touch of truth. It's the capacity we have as human beings. It's wonderful. And then with the third inquiry, again, the rather lovely reporting of the experience that sometimes comes of the cessation of the ordinary notion of self. And then sometimes there's a wonderful sense of being connected to all things. The realization of our interconnected nature. When we know our connection with all things, the ethic that comes through is that obviously to treat another as oneself, as we would wish to be treated. The ethic that comes through is equality. The ethic that we know is love, compassion, kindness in the face of the suffering of another or the suffering of oneself. So our interconnectedness tells us a lot about how to live life with one another, with others who have a different background and culture, religion, and also with regard to our environment. When we feel connected to our environment, we don't want to do things that damage it. So our response in the face of climate change and our possible extinction as human beings needs to be a wise one based on the wisdom of interconnectedness. Now to come back to the inquiry. The fear of annihilation, the fear of the self disappearing. When the self that we know, the self that's familiar, the ordinary I, me and my, the ego, the personality starts to dissolve, we sometimes wonder, what then? We heard it. Yet, if we look at the actuality of the experience, very often, there's the absence of fear. And the encouragement in the world of Dharma is to trust that experience, to see the self disappear, and then ask the question, what remains? And when we do this, what remains is our deep connection with all beings, a sense of love, a sense of freedom. And in that, the fear ceases. So we deconstruct the fear. We see the thoughts that are added to the initial sensation that makes up the fear. We see, oh, there's no evidence for this fear. 300 times. I haven't disappeared. So it's unlikely to happen. The other way to know our freedom, rather than to deconstruct the self, is simply to turn towards it over and over again. So when we face our freedom, our fear ceases. So the two methods of dealing with fear, we face the fear, we deconstruct the notion of self. The fear relies on feeling alone, feeling separate. The other way is to face our freedom. When we face our freedom, fear ends. And we face our freedom. What I mean by that is we incline the mind over and over again to the tiny moments of peace and freedom that we each experience. In any given day, we each have hundreds of moments of the unproblematic, where there is no suffering. Hundreds of moments of no big deal, not a problem. Fear is absent, ill will is absent, greed is absent, confusion is absent. This is our freedom, and we can feel it in the ordinary events of the day. And with our practice, we can also know it rather deeply. So thank you for the inquiries over the last 2 days. Thank you for your attention and for listening so beautifully to the inquiries, because it really does help with the depth. And I think in each of the inquiries we had yesterday and today, we could actually see this beautiful natural movement to freedom, to ease, to that lovely kind of breakthrough moment that we can have when we don't cling anywhere. Give it a try. Thank you. It's now time for walking meditation.